This sound that you're hearing right now is a busy square in Zanzibar. It is the soundscape that a family, which included two schizophrenics, experienced daily. It is not so easy to say all the noise is driving people crazy, but tumult, peacefulness, and family involvement does seem to have some correlation to recovery rates in schizophrenics, and so does culture. I'm Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer, and now we'll be talking with Ethan Waters, who has a new book, Crazy Like Us. It's subtitled The Globalization of the American Psyche. Hello, Mr. Waters.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Your whole book is a great read, but and before we get to Zanzibar, let's start with the chapter on anorexia in Hong Kong, because before they were really exposed to the Western idea of anorexia, people in Hong Kong or doctors that treated it, it was very different. How was the anorexia they experienced different from what we think of as anorexia?
Well, for one, it was extremely rare. So there was doctors, you know, looking into the patient population before 1990 and finding extremely rare cases of anorexia. It tended to happen in a poorer population than we think of it happening here. It tended to happen in slightly older. It didn't have fat phobia. It didn't have body dysmorphia. It had this particular Chinese expression. And the doctors were trying to figure out what that was and to create an approach to treating it, when a very remarkable thing happened. A young woman walking on a downtown street in Hong Kong passed out and died, and she was very clearly an anorexic herself. And the media at that point had to figure out how to explain what had happened. The media caught a hold of the story. And basically what happened was that they imported our Western notions of anorexia. They went to our diagnostic manuals. They went to our experts. They basically reported to the Hong Kong population that this anorexia that happened in Hong Kong was the very same as that experienced in the United States. And after that moment, after the population was introduced in that way to this idea of anorexia, what you saw was a rise in both the prevalence of anorexia and in the American form of anorexia.
So, right. So you follow a Dr. Lee who treated anorexics before this girl collapsed and was it 1994?
That's right.
Yeah. So and like you said, and I just want to underline this point. We think of anorexics as not wanting to get fat and needing to control them, their lives or their weight. And they really want to eat, but they have all these strategies for not eating. And they possibly also think of anorexics, think of it today. You know, there's some famous movie of the week that probably aired in the 70s, but everyone who saw it remembers it. An extremely thin girl looks at herself in the mirror and she sees a fat girl. None of that was happening in Hong Kong.
Right,
people who are anorexic said, yeah, I know I'm extremely thin and I just don't want to eat.
They were complaining mostly of somatic disorders. They would say, I have a blockage in my throat, or I feel bloated in my stomach, the food won't go down. So it was a very sort of, you know, bodily explanation for why they weren't eating, but very different from the American explanation. But that all appeared to change after basically we imported our explanation for anorexia. And the theory behind this is that cultures at different points in history have different symptom pools for how the troubled unconscious mind expresses itself. So in Victorian England, you'd have women experiencing hysterical leg paralysis. At another time, it would be convulsions. At another time, it would be hysterical blindness. And in the era of globalization, now these symptom pools that are particular to one culture can now go across borders. So we can export our own ideas of depression or anorexia to another culture, and it could take root in the unconscious minds of that other population.
In fact, they didn't, well, correct me if I'm wrong, they didn't have a name for anorexia before the girl collapsed, and then in Hong Kong it became known as, I probably pronounced it wrong, Yan Shi Zeng, which
right,
literally
disease
means
the disease of not liking eating, basically.
Not liking but eating, yeah.
They were introduced to Western notions of anorexia, you know, within the mental health population, for instance, because most of those people are trained in some ways in the West. But the population, the key thing is the population didn't think the disease applied to them. They thought this was not a disease that happened in Hong Kong. And then after that one young woman died, suddenly it was in the symptom pool for the time. And this was a very nervous time in Hong Kong. This was after Tiananmen Square and before the Hong Kong the British handover of the province to China. And so there was a lot of nervousness in the air. And at that very moment, we planted in this idea that, you know, that anorexia is a way to express internal distress and potentially actually sparked the rise of the disease by doing so.
Now, you used the phrase a couple times, symptom pool. Could you explain exactly what you mean by that and how it's important in the discussion?
Oh, it's critical. So it's very easy to see across history, and I gave the example of of hysteria in the Victorian era. Most people are a little bit familiar with that. So here was this idea that troubled women would express their disorders through a whole range of very florid symptoms, right? And so when you look at that at a time like that, it's not a matter of those women faking a symptom or make-believing a symptom. It's a matter of the unconscious mind trying to speak the language of suffering for its time. And that changes over time. You have, periods in Europe, you have men walking for hundreds of miles without any knowledge of their who they are. You have, in other cultures, things like choro, with this the debilitating sense that your genitals are retracting into your body and are going to cause death. There's amok. There's all cultures across time and across place have many, many different ways of expressing that internal conflict. There is no one human way of expressing mental illness. And we think in the West, because we think of these things as scientific, in scientific terms, as biomedical terms, we think we're getting beyond culture. But unfortunately, with mental illness, culture always shapes the mental illness. Even if your narrative of explaining it is scientific, that still itself shapes how you think about it, shapes how you think about the way you might recover. It also shapes critically how the people around you will look at you and treat you and think about you. So all these things are cultural, and they all change over time. And my theory is that because America is so prominent in the world of mental health that we're actually homogenizing these ideas across the world, sometimes for the better and oftentimes for the worse.
And one of the quotes a researcher in the book says that microcultures that shape the illness experience of individual patients are being discarded. In the case of Hong Kong, does this mean that the mostly girls who suffered from anorexia pre-1994were being mistreated, were being forced to believe that their symptoms comported with the anorexia as the West knew it?
It's a matter of what they call symptom negotiation. And oftentimes a mentally ill person, say with a symptom of an eating disorder, will come into a doctor and at that moment will begin the process. Through that process of talking to the doctor, they decide which symptoms are quote-unquote real and which ones are not and which ones are going to be ignored. And there's a process of what's called symptom amplification during that back and forth. And that back and forth, what happens with the doctor oftentimes, and it happens with the culture and the people around you who look at certain symptoms and say, yes, that's a real, in our time, we understand that as a real expression of a mental illness. This other thing, we're going to ignore that, and it's probably, and it may, because we're ignoring it, go away. But there's, through that process of illness negotiation, you oftentimes put the person on a track to experience a mental illness in a certain way. And I think that's the theory of what happened over that period in Hong Kong. So it's not just a matter of mistreating or not seeing it. It's a matter of the culture and the doctors and the patients through a back and forth shaping the illness.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, speaking with Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, subtitle, actually supertitled, because this comes above the words Crazy Like Us on the book jacket, The Globalization of the American Psyche. So in the Hong Kong case, talking about anorexia, when anorexia first came to the fore, the public's consciousness, the thought was, thank goodness this disease is now coming out of the shadows. Thank goodness this ailment can now be talked about, can perhaps be addressed. There are cultural problems with anorexia. We should talk about the role that fashion magazines have on our young girls. But there's another side to that sword, isn't there?
Right. So you have to be very careful at these moments because you do want, some public acknowledgement and awareness of a disorder. But at the same time, you don't want to plant a disorder in the population that might have not been there before. And it's pretty clear. You could make the case always that, this rise of depression in Japan was just because they didn't see it before or, something like that.
Yeah.
But with anorexia, it's actually very hard to make that argument because
people either way, 30% under their body weight or they don't.
Right. Yep. Yes, and you tend to notice a starving girl even if you don't have a name for it. And you know, the people that looked for those anorexics looked back in the hospital records, not for the word anorexia, of course, but for women with this behavior. And it really wasn't a prominent disorder in 1980s Hong Kong, and it really was in the latter 90s. So something changed more than just the acknowledgement of it. But then you have to be very careful. And I think that the people that tend to make the mistake are actually not the researchers or the mental health educators, but often the journalists, because we're the ones, I have to hate to say, who like to put the celebrity anorexic on the front page of the magazine and talk about her dramatic recovery. And that's the exact wrong story. That's the exact story that is likely to make the insecure, you know, teenager drift towards the behavior, because suddenly their favorite star has this grand story of recovering from anorexia.
Right, and the star will always say, if my story can help one anorexic, they won't say, if my story can prompt five more anorexics.
And that's the situation when we seldom think about it. And I guess journalists sometimes think about that when we write about suicides.
Yes.
We know that that's contagious. But we tend to love the new disorder. Cutting, is the new disorder, or whatever it is. We tend to love that story, and we tend not to think that the way we tell it may actually be a cue for the unconscious mind to attach to it.
Now let's move to Zanzibar and schizophrenia, and I think we'll come back to PTSD if we have time. But perhaps the notion of schizophrenia is it's a disorder of the brain, and perhaps you treat it with drugs, but it doesn't seem to be, or perhaps people wouldn't think it would be, so culturally sensitive. Either people have this disorder in the brain and maybe there's some genetic component, or they don't. How is it culturally sensitive?
Well, it's very clear that something is going on culturally, and the World Health Organization did a 30-year study of schizophrenics across the world, and what they found this very remarkable finding, which is that schizophrenics in developing countries tend to do much better, not just a little better, but much better than schizophrenics diagnosed in the first world. So something is happening, and I followed an anthropologist down to Zanzibar who spent a great deal of time with a few families because she was trying to figure out what cultural stories are told about the ill person, how is it thought about, and how does that shape the ill person's experience and the way people treat her, them. And the theory she came up with was that the spirit possession notion in Zanzibar was, we think of that in the West as certainly being amazingly stigmatizing,
right.
And hopefully we can erase that through our biomedical narrative about schizophrenia. Well, in fact, oftentimes that spirit possession notion is actually helps keep the person within the group. That is, it helps minister to the person, express kindness to the person, give the person an excuse for the behavior so that it takes away blame from the individual.
Because we should point out that in Zanzibar, a Muslim, predominantly Muslim country, it's a different version of the spirit possession than we've seen in The Exorcist, violently trying to cast out the spirits.
Exactly. Everyone in Zanzibar talks about spirit possession. You know, everyone thinks they have spirits of relatives that exist within them, and it's a very common narrative, and spirits are not cast out, for the most part, they're not cast out through cruelty. They're fetid, they're placated, they're reduced in malfeasance through a variety of sort of social interactions, and those social interactions may indeed be why that families in Zanzibar and traditional cultures in general tend to have a much lower emotional temperature in the household of the schizophrenic. That is, there's less worry about the behavior. There's less trying to change the behavior. There's more acceptance of the burden. And overall, that's one of the theories as to why that WHO study might have shown such a difference between the outcomes of schizophrenics in the third world and the outcomes of schizophrenics in the first world. It's not that Americans are cruel to their mentally ill, or we're simply applying our notions of the human self to the schizophrenic person by saying we assume that the individual is sort of locked in the mind and has, and should be able to chart their own destiny and should be able to change their behavior out of force of will. That's an American idea, and it's not a good one or a bad one necessarily, but in this particular, as it plays out with the mentally ill, it might indeed be more healing to have a notion of the self that is not locked in the mind, that is in the so, that that is shared among the social group, that is shared among, you know,
Yeah, just, and this is Mike Pesca in for Brian Lehrer, speaking with Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us. And there is a phrase in the book and in medical literature, highly expressed emotion. And this is the idea that schizophrenics who have family members who are extra invested in the schizophrenic's recovery, who often report things like, you know, I just want to, I think there was one woman quoted, I just want to quit my job and spend all my time with my daughter and cover her and protect her like a pearl. This is very bad for the treatment of schizophrenics, the literature shows. And in the developing world, it's less likely to happen than in America, where we all believe we're the authors of our own fate.
That's right, and you know it's bad on average. So I wouldn't say you know that every parent that does that or does something like that is necessarily causing a higher relapse rate. But when you study this on average, the relapse rates in schizophrenia and worse outcomes tend to be tied to emotional settings that have high, what's called high expressed emotion, and it's a fairly significant effect. But you wouldn't find it in every family. And the researchers that I've talked to, again, are not saying that Americans are bad or wrong in doing this. In fact, this is an expression of the American sense of self. And in other places, I think not only schizophrenia, but illness in general is treated with a much more resignation in a way. You know, they deal with much more of it, in fact.
Right. Now, it's funny because your researcher in Zanzibar spent time with two families, and one had two schizophrenics, and that was from the sound that we heard at the top of the hour. But, you know, if the girl felt up to it, she'd help with the chores, and if she didn't, she'd be allowed to retreat, and there wasn't a lot of pressure on her. In the other family, there was a brother of a schizophrenic who was very into Western medicine and knew a lot about the side effects of medication and, you know, even had intimate details that about his sister that probably transgressed a lot of the cultural norms. In the case of treating schizophrenia, unlike treating another disease, unlike treating cancer, it might be counter to the recovery of a schizophrenic to have that much knowledge and involvement and to buy into the Western notion of schizophrenia, you're saying.
That's right. And it goes to this sort of basic idea about that biomedical notion. We assume that biomedical notion of mental illness will reduce stigma. And in fact, when you study that, even within our culture, people who adopt that belief about mental illness tend to want more distance from the sick person. And this is true of the other family in Zanzibar. They tend to think of that person as more intractably broken. They tend to think that they can treat that person a little differently or even significantly differently than they treat other, quote-unquote, normal humans. Unfortunately, like everywhere that that biomedical notion has been adopted, you tend not to see a reduction in stigma, but an increase in stigma. And the people that have studied this actually believe that there's a cause and effect here, that it has to do with adopting that notion. And that is true when it's studied even in America.
Now, here is the question or insight that occurred to me as I was reading your book: is the problem that these cultural differences and exporting our notions of mental health? Or is the problem really that we don't have a cure for these ailments? I mean, if that brother, if this over-involved brother had the same attitude and his sister was suffering from scurvy and he said, let's not live our lifestyle, let's listen to Western medicine, she would be cured of scurvy. The same thing with the PTSD researchers who descend on Sri Lanka. If instead of trying to cure PTSD, they were trying to cure diabetes, those people would be better off. So isn't that a major problem, that some of these mental ailments don't really have a simple cure?
That's absolutely true. And we're certainly moving, we have great progress on that front, but none of the drugs we have are actually very good. Some of them, we should export because they have some effect. We should not shield the rest of the world from our medical advances. Absolutely. And you could look 10 years ahead into the future or 20 years ahead in the future and say, you know, at some point we're going to have better drugs for these things and we should share them with the rest of the world. But that said, we can try to figure out how to share these drugs with the rest of the world without undermining local beliefs that may themselves be curative. Right now, there is no cure, surefire biomedical cure for anorexia or schizophrenia. It still exists within the social realm. understanding the ill person, understanding their life experience. It's trying to, you know, to care for them. And different cultures have different ways of doing that. And we're not yet to a point with our medical advances where we can say, you really should be thinking like us, as in, as with the examples, the medical examples you just mentioned.
Now, and it also occurs to me, let's jump to your last big example, an interesting chapter on the army of mental health experts who descended on Sri Lanka after the tsunami, and they were trying to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. It occurs to me that maybe that treatment would work in the West, because the underlying message seems to be, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. Or not don't worry, but in the end, you'll get through it and everything's going to be okay. You can't really give that message to a Sri Lankan. It's not an honest message for them, although you detail all the other cultural differences of people trying to help Sri Lankans in a way that maybe wasn't working for them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the point is that notion of PTSD and how to heal from it makes sense in America. I mean, we've created this ideas about PTSD. We have a certain set of symptoms we look for. We have a certain set of expectations about how to deal with it. We think talking it through at the earliest opportunity is curative. Those ideas jive with Americans' understanding of the self and America's understanding of the mind. When you go and take them and assume that they work in Sri Lanka, that the Sri Lankan people have the same idea, oftentimes you have tremendous cultural conflicts, and it doesn't make as much sense. They have different symptoms. In Sri Lanka, the sense of damage after an event like the tsunami tends to be seen conceptualized not as in the mind, but in the social setting. That is, my social group is broken, and I'm unable to fulfill my social role in this group, and that's causing me great distress. So for an American, when the illness is in the mind, it makes perfect sense to go off with a counselor and say, I'm going to take time away from my social responsibilities to heal from this idea of PTSD in my mind.
Right, you need some time for you, which is, yes, would be exactly the worst. Do you know if these researchers or people are going to Haiti?
There already is some ramping up of trauma counseling in Haiti, and I think we should be very careful about that, because even in a poor country, we can't assume they need our help, of course, you know, in all sorts of different ways, and everyone should be doing their part to try to help this. But when it comes to psychological resilience, for an American culture, a rich American culture, to go into a poor country and say, we're going to tell you how to deal with trauma and stress, there's something really dehumanizing about that. This is a culture that these are people that have a different psychology, and in all likelihood are vastly more capable than we are of psychological stress of handling trauma. And for us to say, we know the symptoms, we need to teach you the symptoms, and we need to teach you these modern ways of healing, is really problematic, and could at a really bad moment in time undercut the local notions of how to heal, local notions of how to get on with the life, and pathologize a population, psychologically pathologize a population that needs as much of its own resilience as it can.
Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Thank you very much, Ethan.
Thank you so much. It's been enjoyable.
And before we move on to the next segment, I wanted to update you on something that came up on the show yesterday. There was a listener named Charles, and he called in about the dire situation in Haiti. And he talked about his mother, who was an American living in Port-au-Prince. And the last he knew, she was trapped in her building, which collapsed. There was a great outpouring from the Brian Lehrer Show listeners, and they worried about Charles. They wanted to know what we could do for him. The producers took his information, they took his mother's address, they passed it along to local elected officials, local New York officials, and to relief organizations working in Haiti. There's no firm update, but the Brian Lehrer Show knows about this, and Brian will be back on Monday, and we will certainly update you when we learn anything.